Oh, thank you, Richard, for asking. It's stressful. It's stressful. And all this on top of presidential election and a country that's showing its true colors that, at times seem very ugly. A new city. I uprooted my life a couple of years ago to come to San Francisco, and that's hugely exciting, hugely rewarding. But to live in a new city that's sort of forfeits shut down is stressful. Like it's kind of amazing.
Are you sleeping?
No. Who's sleeping? Are you sleeping?
You've been listening to an interview with Pam MacKinnon, who is the artistic director of ACT, American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. And to find out more and to listen and watch more, you can go to act-sf.org. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. The complete interview can be found as a Bay Area Theater podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. During her heyday from the late 60s until the mid-90s, Anne McCaffrey, who died in 2011 at the age of 85, was one of the most popular and successful writers in the science fiction field. Her most famous series of novels, The Dragon Riders of Pern, put her on the map, and her novel, The White Dragon, was one of the first science fiction books from within the genre to land on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list. But her output over her career also included several other series of novels: the Crystal series, the Brain and Brawn Ship series, the Dinosaur Planet series, the Talent series, the Tower and the Hive series, the Poseidon series, and others written in collaboration with other writers, including several late Dragon Rider novels written with her son Todd McCaffrey. As with other well-known writers of the era, her popularity has fallen over the years because her books were never adapted for television or film, though Dragon Riders did become a video game. On June 29, 1992, my late partner on Probabilities, Richard A. Lupoff, and I sat down with Anne McCaffrey to discuss her career, as well as her two most recent books at the time, The Rowan and Damia, both of which had been published in the previous 2 years.
You consider yourself a science fiction writer. In fact, I believe you're quite emphatic about that.
Yes, I am.
But your books, in particular the Dragon books, are very, very popular with fans and collectors of fantasy. Why do you think that is, and how do you respond to it?
Well, dragons have, until I got a hold of them, been more or less creatures of fantasy. But I made them, Bob Heinlein did too. He had them breathing methane gas, which gave them fire breathing capacity. But he only mentions them briefly in Glory Road. But I had a whole culture based on the need of friendly dragons, user friendly dragons, which I said, even early on, had been biogenetically created from indigenous sources, and that makes them science fiction.
Had you intended after the two trilogies to continue writing them?
I did and I didn't. I had done six quite successful novels. I was quite ready to leave it there, but my son Todd kept needling me. He said, "Mother, you haven't solved the problem." And also Owen Locke and Shelley Shapiro, who became my editors after Jody Lynn Delray's death. I still hadn't solved the problem that I set out to solve in the first book, so what are you going to do about this, Anne? Well, any real reader of science fiction will quickly realize I had written myself into a corner by the end of White Dragon. So I had to set the groundwork for the final denouement and the solution. That took three books.
Oh, so that would be Dragonstone, Renegades of Pern, and All the Wares of Pern.
Yeah, they're the final trilogy.
And is that it for the dragons?
No, there's going to be another book. I don't know what we're going to call it. They keep liking Kern in the title, but actually my young friend is dealing with the dolphins of Kern. There are three short stories. I shall be going on with not a mainline book because I've solved the main problem. But there will be other, if you'll excuse me, threads that I have to tie up. And then there will be an anthology which will include the Girl Who Heard Dragons. You read the back end of that in Renegades of Kern.
I've been looking over your list of publications and publishers. In fact, I remember when your very first novel, Restory, appeared. I grabbed it up, that little Ballantine book. I was doing some research at the time and ran home with it and read this book. I said, gee, who is this Anne McCaffrey? But I noticed over the years, among the many editors you've worked with, was some work you did with a fellow named Roger Elwood, who breezed through the science fiction field some years ago.
Yeah, the Mad Anthologist.
Well, his name is largely forgotten by today's readers.
Mm-hmm.
But those of us who've been around a bit longer all carry strong recollections of him. What was your experience like?
I never actually met him until long after he'd stopped his anthologizing. I was in Ireland, in fact. And he kept after me through my agent, Virginia Kidd, to write stories based on this and that theme. And I was broke in those days. It was pancake time. Like, Mother, wouldn't it be nice to have pancakes because we wanted them? Once in a while, we still go out to IHOP and get some. He did a lot of children books. I did a proper Santa Claus for him. He changed the ending, but I put it back and get off the unicorn to the proper ending. I did Finder's Keeper. I tried to do a story with Mennelly in it, and it would not write for Roger. Instead, I gave him The Smallest Dragon Boy, which to my complete surprise has become one of the most reprinted stories I've written. And it has ended up in textbooks. And I ran into some kids at a signing at Christmas time, and they came over and said, we had to read your story. Smallest Dragon Boy? Yeah. Did you like it? Yeah. Then I sicked them on my kid brother, Kevin, who was the sort of the model for the hero in the story. He has forgiven me since then. But
well, have you? You've come a very long way from Restory. You have become almost a cultural icon of contemporary science fiction writers. How do you deal with it? Do you walk around, you know, looking down your nose at the rest of the world?
Would do what? You must be bloody joking.
Well, seriously, how do you deal with this? It's such a change from struggling beginner which you were.
Running around hoping people wouldn't notice I'd slipped in the back door. I do live in Ireland, which keeps me out of the everyday stream. Not to mention that there are people who don't knock on my door and come in for a cup of tea. Most of them are welcome to stay, and the others we have a drill for getting rid of. But when I'm being Anne McCaffrey, the author in the States, I am playing a part, the part that I'm expected to play by the people who want to meet me. I'm unfortunately much the same person at home alone, but I hide behind the Anne McCaffrey big-name author. And so it doesn't affect me at all, because when I go home, I'll get a bad review, and I'll think, yeah, they were right about that. It wasn't that good, you know. So I keep my head.
These books are immensely popular, and I wonder, with regard to science fiction in general and with regard to your own works in particular, you will recall there was a debate years ago before the big establishment critics discovered that science fiction was wonderful, okay? In those days, science fiction people were very defensive about their field and kept saying things like, well, mainstream literature may have better style, but we have all these wonderful ideas. Was that ever valid to start with, and is it valid today?
It may well be valid today, but I have always stood straight and tall and said, I write science fiction, and if you care to make something about that, go right ahead, mate. I'm proud of what I write. I write the best I can. And I know I interest a lot of people. So I've never poor-mouthed myself or the field.
But I think the question remains, are the essential criteria of a good science fiction novel the same as the essential criteria of a good mainstream novel, or let's say a good mystery novel.
Yes, because you have to tell a story with an interesting plot, with good characterization, and some little bits and pieces around the edges that people have not encountered before. If you're a craftsman of any kind, you try to use the best within yourself and within your craft to do it. And science fiction in the early 60s decided to improve the product with Damon Knight and Judy Merrill and Kate Wilhelm with the Milford Science Fiction Writers Association, which I attended quite a few times. In fact, I started one in England called the Milford. We found another Milford. It wasn't hard. And Jim Blish was sort of the head, but he couldn't speak that long. He had cancer of the throat. So rather than have Brian Aldiss and John Brunner at each other's throat, they chose me as as the chairperson until they began to do it on typically English.
I hope at least some of our readers know who these folks are that you're referring to, because, again, those of us who have been in the field for many years know exactly who they were and why you say the things you do. But maybe you should give us a little sketch of these personalities.
Well, Jim Blish was a slim man who used to eat his lunch at his table with two martinis and write astounding stories. The best known ones, I think, are The Cities in Flight and A Case of Conscience and his Dr. Mirabilis. And A Case of Conscience is still, I think, one of the classics that everyone should read.
He also wrote the novelizations for the original Star Trek.
Yes, and he was a much better Star Trek writer than Gene Roddenberry ever deserved. John Brunner is very much your archetypal Oxford don. He's extremely erudite. His grammar is superb, but he does have a tendency to look down his nose on the lesser lights, and he has a nose to look down with. However, John and I have long since reached a balance and are very civil to each other, and in fact, I do enjoy his company. Brian Aldiss is the gentleman of all time, and really, he is a very sweet, wonderful person. And he only sells a book when he has finished it. And I think he, John, and one or two others, would I rather not name right now, because I'm not going to name the right ones, are probably the top stylists in the field of science fiction.
Now, you have style in your writings, and you have science fiction elements in your writings, but it seems to me, and I could be, you know, this is one person's observation, that your focus is more on character.
Oh, yes, much more. On how people will respond to the challenges they meet and the circumstances into which they find themselves. I had took the loggerheads with one bibliographer who said that I used the Cinderella theme. No way. Cinderella was a wimp, and most of my female characters have been strong, mainly because I was around strong characters most of my life. What I have are survivors, people who are in difficult circumstances, who somehow or other manage to overcome them with just plain guts or with guile, one or the other, or good luck always features in coming out of a survival situation, but mainly it is surviving.
In the mid-1970s, there's an essay that appears in a book. What's the name of that book?
20th Century Science Fiction Authors.
There's an essay that appears in 20th Century Science Fiction Authors that you wrote in the mid-70s that says, "I am not a feminist, though I believe in strong women." Do you see yourself more as a feminist now, or is that simply not changed?
It's not changed a bit. I'm still, you know, if you've got the character to do it, you'll do it. A lot of feminism, which I, the bra-burning stuff, if you're a responsible person, you stand up on your own two feet and say, "I didn't make it this way because I couldn't, I didn't have the stuff, it's my responsibility," and you take the lumps with everything else.
In one of your earlier books, The Kiltinen Legacy, you discussed the life of women in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Has that improved?
Slightly. That man can't sell the family house out from underneath her without her signature on a paper. In fact, when I sold Dragon Hold recently to move into a new house, I had to prove that my ex-husband had never been in Ireland, had never been in my house. It worked both ways. I couldn't sell it out from underneath him now either. But as he never had, there's no problem.
You've worked outside of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
In romance. Have you done mysteries?
Well, sort of romantic mysteries, things that were fairly easily solved, but not of the type that, I'm thinking J.B. Fletcher, and I know that's not what I want.
Agatha Christie, P.D. James.
Agatha Christie, Josephine Tay, some of those people, no.
Well, nonetheless, I wonder how you have felt when you moved out of a field in which you are so thoroughly familiar with all of the landscape and furniture into a new realm. Did you have any particular jolt of, what's the term, the shock of the familiar? Did you experience the shock of the unfamiliar when you moved into these other fields?
Yes, Richard, I think I did, because it's much harder to write in contemporary vein, because you're not making up the et ceteras. When I wrote what they laughingly called here the lady, which I preferred to call the Carradine touch, it's about a horse family in Ireland, and I did a lot of research on time, on what was going on, what the weather was like, on the horse situation, the international situation, the situation in Ireland, and I had that as a framework that I could use, so I was certain that historically, when I put things, they were correct. And I find that much more difficult for me to do.
What era was that?
Oh, that came out in 86, I think, 87.
You're listening to a June 1992 interview with the late science fiction author Anne McCaffrey, who died in 2011 at the age of 85. My co-host for this Archive Probabilities interview was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
You've also recently been working a lot with collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Moon, there are two books. Jody Lynn Nye, there's two books. And Margaret Ball, I have listed one book.
Mm-hmm.
Are these collaborations put together the same way? And what way is that, or are they different? Is each one different?
They were actually packaged by Bill Fawcett Associates. And he came to me and he said, look, the mid-list writers are really getting in the crunch. And I figured out an idea. If we pair you with some of the good mid-list writers, perhaps they will get the publicity and the notice that they deserve. So what I did was to sit down and write a general outline, which my collaborator could then change if they had a brilliant inspiration. And Elizabeth had a marvelous one in Generation Warriors of the heavy worlders opera, and it was absolutely beautiful. So we both had input once we did the skeleton, and that worked very well. In fact, there's a fifth one coming out with Mercedes Lackey that I'm extremely excited about. I think she's a marvelous new young writer.
So these are actual collaborations in terms of the writing itself, not just the outline as well?
Yeah, that's right. And I did an in-house collaboration with Elizabeth Ann Scarborough. She was a Nebula winner for the very fine Healer's War. And she had come over to beg house room with me. She wanted to do some research in Irish folk music and Scotch folk music. And I said, yeah, come on, I got this new house, and come on over and stay with me for a while. So she did. And in the evenings, when we both finished the work day, as it were, we'd sit around and we were tossing things back and forth. And I said, what we really should do is something using our own experiences. She, of course, had lived in Alaska and had been in Vietnam. And I've been in Ireland, which is slightly alien. It really is at times. So we decided to do a book together. And we figured out who the main characters were. And I said, well, I want to start off with Yanaba. I like her. So I started off the first chapter and a half. And then I was working on Crystalline at the time. And I had a real hot idea to go on in that book. It's the third Kilashandra. So I passed the disc over to her. And she took off and did the next chapter and a half or something. And then we'd sort of work along and do the framework based on the original idea. And that developed the plot and the planet.
Well, now that you've done all of these books in collaboration, how do you feel about working in collaboration as opposed to working by yourself?
So long as I get my way, I don't mind at all. No, actually, I'm quite willing to listen to what any other writer wants to say, and we can talk it over and find out whether it will work.
Do you find it easier, harder?
Most of the time it's easier because you've got two minds to work out details. And, for instance, Elizabeth Moon is a Marine captain. I had a father who was in the Army, but she knew the military or the naval aspects that helped build Sassenach as a character and later Generation Warriors. Margaret Ball is very interested in space drive. She figured out the singularity drive and explained it to me, which she had to, because I didn't know what she was talking about.
Do you understand it?
Not really, but it works.
Okay.
At least in the books it does. And each of us have had something to give the other. And that's when a partnership or a collaboration works.
At one point, you had said that The Ship Who Sang was your favorite story among what you had written. Is that still true?
Oh, yeah. I think so.
If you were to be remembered for anything, would that be what you would want?
For Ship, yes, I would like to be remembered. I'll probably be the Dragon Lady till the day I die, but I'm not unproud of them either.
You've been involved with science fiction since the late 1950s,
mm-hmm.
and it seems to me, having been involved with it pretty much the same time period that you have, it's undergone an awful lot of changes. I wonder how you feel about those changes and whether you feel that they're just fashion. People are wearing green hats today and they'll wear blue hats tomorrow, or whether you think this is really a change at the heart and core of science fiction.
I'm not a very good one to ask that sort of a question, although I think I can answer it this time. We all understand that from the time Star Trek started and the Star Wars and E.T., that we had a much broader reading base. That reading base wants more the same stories that they loved, either on the screen or the tube. We're getting two and three generations. I've had grandmothers come up and say that they had introduced their sons and daughters to my books, and now they were reading to their grandchildren. Well, that's pretty good, thank you. But for a long while there in the 80s, I think people read science fiction because we were talking of futures, and people were very worried that they might not have one. Once they realized just how wide open the field is to imagination, to all kinds of unthought of things that are within the range of probability, not possibility, maybe both. I think they want to come back to it again and will stay with it because it does give you some place to escape to. And it's marvelous fun. And certainly in many cases now, the writing is far above what it used to be in the good old pulp days. And we, the writers of science fiction, have done that. We've improved the product to the point where it is remarkably saleable.
So you think we're kind of in a golden age now?
Well, Damon Knight used to say it went in 12-year cycles. I don't know where he got that one from, but for a while it was right. As long as we can keep thinking up new things to interest the human mind, I don't see why we can't go on.
Anne McCaffrey, you start this new series, which is about people with psychic powers able to use their psychic powers for space travel. What brought you to that idea?
Well, actually, The Rowan was a story I did in 1958. There not being sufficient romance in the world, Berkeley Putnam asked me, could I put it back in? And suggested that I expand the story, A Lady in the Tower, into The Rowan, which is what I did. And as I'd done a second story in 1967 for fantasy and science fiction called A Meeting of Minds, in which I deal with the Rowan's daughter Damia, I've sort of done them both, only it looks like they're going to work into a four-book series.
It would appear that the Damia does not exactly end at an ending. It seems like there's going to be more material involving the three alien races.
Mm-hmm.
The Rowan, when you say that you started it in 1958, you wrote the first story, at that point you had just come out of doing some work with John W. Campbell. You wrote for him for
Astounding. The Rowan predates Campbell a long ways.
It predates Campbell?
Oh, yeah, that was 58. I didn't get to know John Campbell until 1965, 66.
Because it seems to tie in terms of his interest in psychic powers.
They were psychic powers all on my own, before I even knew that John would permit such things in analog.
it seems that Psychic Powers seems to cover a number of your works, Crystal Singer certainly, as well as the psychic relation with the Dragon books.
Yeah, not Crystal Singer. I mean, all she has is perfect pitch and a bad temper. That's beside the point. Yes, I do use a lot of the psychic. I use them in the Pegasus series and, of course, in the Damien and Rowan. In fact, To Ride Pegasus and Pegasus in Flight were supposed to be sort of the beginning of this whole thing, the end of which is the Rowan, Damien, Damien's children. But I couldn't put it all in the one book, so it's developed into 4 or 5 or 6 or I don't know. You know, you grab something and you see the ramifications and you get involved in the people. Actually, I get very interested in the people and I continue with them.
Is there a way to bring all of them into one universe?
Not very likely. I mean, each universe has its own peculiarities and its own fortes, and I'm not about to try to rationalize them all. I don't think I could.
Because it seems like a number of authors have made the attempt. Asimov, of course, by bringing his Robot and Foundation series into one.
Well, that was a good doctor, and he's a hell of a much better writer than I am.
In your new book, Damia, you do have these psi powers in which people move spaceships and cargoes by pure mental effort.
With a little help from generators.
Okay. I'd like you to talk about this topic because there is also hardware-type space travel involved as well. Spaceships with space drives, as mm-hmm. Going back to Frank R. Paul-type
right.
Nuts and bolts mm-hmm. and rivets sticking out all over the place. It seems to me that on some sort of conceptual or even philosophical level, there is a conflict between those two concepts. How do you make them work together?
By not going into a great deal of detail, of course. My people, the Rowan from Callisto Station on the moon, can send people in the general direction they want to go. But they'll have to go under power to do the fine driving and landing, in most cases, unless they are near enough to one of the big towers to be dropped neatly into a cradle.
Anne McCaffrey, are you using the Dragon books as a commentary, or is that pure science fiction?
That's pure science fiction. People dealing, surviving under their own merits at a low level of technology, which was one of the premises originally, and what will happen when they suddenly don't need it anymore.
What about the new books, The Rowan and Damia? Is there anything there? If not from now, from 1958?
In 1958, when I was trying to bust into science fiction, I realized there were no really decent love things. And I read a marvelous series of books. There were two or three of them, short stories, I think in fantasy and science fiction, about telepaths on Mars. I don't know who wrote them, but the stories themselves really grabbed me. And that's what I wanted to emulate in my fashion. And having felt myself as a child very much a loner, maybe because I was such a brat, no one would play with me. I earned it. I think I put a lot of me in the Rowan at that stage.
How much of the Rowan and Damia were rewritten? Currently, recently?
Very little. I updated certain of the language for the Rowan, and except for cleaning up the language and bringing it up to date, as it were, I didn't change much. Likewise with Damia and the Meeting of Minds, although I made her less of an idiot.
Well, you also have a fairly explicit sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not in 1958.
Oh, either. Yes, that was
In Damia.
In Damia, yeah, that was in.
Oh,
it ends on the line. So Dan may have loved you in his fashion, says Aphra, but mine will be much more satisfying to you than a meeting of minds.
For nearly two decades after this interview, Anne McCaffrey continued to write and collaborate. Each of the collaborations mentioned in the interview spawned multiple novels, And while she may have only been planning to write one more Dragon Rider's book, The Dolphins of Pern, which was published in 1994, she wrote three more novels in the series and a story collection, and followed these with another four written in collaboration with her son Todd, who also wrote two more in the series under his own name. My co-host for this Probabilities Archive interview was Richard A. Lupoff. And I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 19 de noviembre del 2020. Una persona muere de coronavirus cada 17 segundos en Europa, ha dicho el jefe regional de la Organización Mundial de la Salud, ya que la pandemia continúa amenazando con abrumar los sistemas nacionales de salud en todo el continente. The Guardian reporta. El número oficial de muertos en los Estados Unidos por COVID-19 ha superado el cuarto de millón de personas a medida que el virus se descontrola de costa a costa, con 172 mil infecciones y